Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I am Kara Santa Maria, and I'm really excited about today's episode because it is the first in-studio episode that I've recorded in a while. In studio. That sounds so professional. By in studio, I mean in my dining room. But it was a whole lot of fun. Before I introduce my guest, I want to thank those of you who support the podcast in the many ways that you do. I actually don't have a sponsor for this week's episode, which is kind of a bummer because the sponsorships really do help support the show. If any of you listening have your own business, for example, hit me up. You can shoot me a message on Facebook, which is facebook.com/sciencekara, or you can even send an email directly to me at shoptalknerdy@gmail.com. And let me know if you're interested in partnering with me, doing a little advertising on the show. Also, if you are an international listener and you've wanted to buy something from the Talk Nerdy store and you haven't been able to use the shopping carts software because it doesn't really service most countries, you can also hit me up there, shoptalknerdy@gmail.com, and you can place an international order and we'll just check out via PayPal. Speaking of the store, you can visit at carasantamaria.com and click on the icon for store. And there's all sorts of cool stuff for sale there. T-shirts and slap bracelets and cool little sticker button packs and even really beautiful hand-tooled leather bookmarks and keychains and even handmade mugs. Really, really fun. Check it out. It's a great way to support the show. Speaking of supporting the show, so many great segues here at the top. I want to give a shout out to a handful of you who have supported the show this week and who have really given quite a bit to support the show. I really appreciate it. First is Dennis Wilson from Clinton, Washington, who made a donation through the website via the PayPal portal. And next, I want to thank the awesome patrons that continue to support the show on Patreon. There are 50 of you now, so there's too many to list, but some of my top contributors. Once again, I want to thank Ron. You reached out to me and you corrected my pronunciation of your last name. I'm so sorry I pronounced it wrong, and I still don't know if I get it. Is it Knobloch, or maybe it's Knobloch? But either way, Ron, thank you so much. Thank you for your sweet note that you sent me too. Hey, shoot me another message and tell me the name of your daughters, and I'll send some swag their way. I also want to thank Rob Barcy, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell. You guys are amazing. We are getting there. I think I'm almost at a place where I can buy us some new microphones and really up the production value of the show. I'm super excited about it. So you guys, I couldn't do it without you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. I know you're sick of listening to me blabber on and you want to hear my guest. I'm super pumped to have her on the show this week. She is an actress she has a recurring role on the show Granite Flats. She's also done tons of cool web series, lots with a sci-fi focus. She's also a writer and producer, and she is the fourth interview I've done in the series, I guess you could say, of the four wonderful women who make up the Actresses for STEM group called Sirens. So welcome her to the show. It's Taryn O'Neill. Taryn, thank you so much. Get comfortable.
Okay, I'm like hitting the mic.
Get comfortable. Thank you so much for coming all this way from the marina.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Joining me here in Hollywood. I've got to say, I'm excited because I feel like these types of episodes are my favorite types of episodes where I get it. Don't get me wrong. I am incredibly like in awe and grateful that we have the technology to be able to interview people that are like across the world or across the country. Mm-hmm. And so when I do these things remotely, it just blows my mind that I can sometimes sort of edit them so it sort of sounds like we're in the same room. But the truth is, I think a lot is lost. And I'm so excited when I actually get to sit across the table from somebody and have like a really, I don't know, honest chat with them.
Because so, you can see my eyes.
I can see your eyes. It's true. Because you know what? You usually Skype when you podcast remotely, but because it sucks up so much bandwidth, you kind of have to turn off the video.
Right.
So it's still just a voice, like a disembodied voice, which is weird.
How many do you do remotely?
I did the last, let me see. I've been doing quite a few lately just because the people that I've been having on just haven't been like coming to LA. So let's see, Natalie Panic, she was in Canada. Chris Mooney was in DC, Hank Green. So the last three were remote.
And I was thinking before when I saw that you interviewed Hank, I'm like, he came here. That's so cool. But no, that was okay.
And the weird thing is, Hank's still the only person in the history of Talk Nerdy. So now I'm talking about, gosh, what episode are we on? This is episode
60 something?
59, almost 60. So in the last 59 episodes, Hank is the only person who I've had on the podcast who I still haven't met in person.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is super weird. I've met his brother, but I've never met him.
I've only seen him in passing at like VidCon or something, and I'm such a nerd fighter geek girl where I'm like, you are so awesome. I have so many friends who are friends with him, and I'm like, can you just introduce me to Hank?
He's so cool.
Because you are the coolest.
And I've never even been to VidCon. He actually emailed me like a few days ago now, and was like, OMG, Adam and His Package is coming to my band show. I'm so excited. And you probably don't know who Adam and His Package is because nobody does. But Hank and I are like the only two people on the planet who love Adam and listen. I shouldn't say that. Adam has a lot of fans, but it's very rare for me to meet people in person because it's like the epitome of nerddom. And so I was like, I'm so jealous. I wish I was going. Anyway, that's
a rant. Adam and His Package.
Adam and His Package. Adam, A-T-O-M. Look him up. Okay. Look him up, kids. You'll love him. I hope. Or you'll think that it's...
We'll tweet about it later.
The craziest thing you've ever heard. It's so good. I love it. So Taryn, I'm excited to have you on because you are the fourth and final chapter of The Sirens. I've had everybody else on before you. So, and you know what? Last but not least. I think it's going to be good.
Me.
You know what? You're probably the nerdiest of The Sirens. Do you think that's true? Do you think that's safe to say?
I think Tamara's pretty nerdy as well.
Really?
Yeah.
You think she's as nerdy as you are?
Maybe not like in the sci-fi way, but then she is like the Marvel host and she knows comics and that is sort of something that I lack when it comes to my geekdom. You know, I became a geek later in life and so I think there was like these levels of geekdom that you had to ascend to like, you know, I'd go to Comic-Con and be like, oh my gosh, please don't ask me like these comic questions because I wouldn't know. But yeah, I'm pretty sci-fi nerdy and then science nerdy, obviously.
The funny thing is, Tamara and I literally didn't talk about anything nerdy. Well, that's not true. We talked about nerdy things, but we didn't get into comics at all when she was on the show. We mostly talked about acting, which is kind of interesting. Maybe it's because it was new to me, and I was like,
right.
Oh, tell me everything.
Were you talking about theater acting?
Yeah,
too,
we were talking about we were talking about unions, which is really interesting to me because I think it has broader implications than just equity to be able to talk about unions across the board and how it relates to anybody in their field and their relationship with their representation. But you mentioned, and I think that's an interesting point to mention, that I get, not that I get heat really, but I think different people define nerd or geek or dork or whatever the term is differently. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a label, I guess, that is a personal one. I think of myself as a very nerdy person. The show is called Talk Nerdy, but my nerdery really comes from core kind of scientific interests. Mm-hmm. For some people, their nerdery, like think of Hardwick, right? Hardwick is probably not really a science connoisseur. I mean, I think that he likes science and he appreciates science,
it.
Of course. But I think his nerdery comes from these sort of fandom places like comic books and sci-fi and things like that. And I get kind of annoyed when people think that you have to have them all or something to be a true nerd. It's sort of like a bummer to me when I'm like, what? I'm a nerd.
I know. I agree. And I've always been really defensive when, you know, people have this kind of blanket list of what you need to know. Like, what? You haven't seen all 11 seasons of Doctor Who and blah, blah. You don't have your favorite doctor. And I'm like, I only started later in life. Geekdom is just, I think that you become a geek or you become a nerd over what speaks to you and what unites you with a community. That's sort of where I found it. I started producing a sci-fi web series and I was up in Vancouver and I was auditioning for a lot of sci-fi shows and I'd never liked I've never been a huge sci-fi fan. I mean, I loved Alias, and I was a huge Buffy fan, but that's not sci-fi, that's fantasy. Mm-hmm. And I also, you know, I loved Star Trek Next Generation growing up, but I wouldn't have called myself, like, a sci-fi geek. I didn't read Asimov growing up. I didn't read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, any of this. I mean, I read friggin', like, Nancy Drew and Daniel Steele, besides, like, all my school stuff.
Yeah.
Because I was a big nerd in school, but it was more of an academic nerd. But then when I started auditioning for all these sci-fi shows and then producing a sci-fi web series, I'm like, this culture is so fascinating. And then the themes that these sci-fi narratives are bringing to life really connect with me, and it kind of opened this portal.
So tell me about that first...
Excuse me.
I'm like, and Killer is over here, by the way, like scratching at the carpet. I'm not sure if you could hear that. It's a noisy day today, actually. There are a lot of helicopters outside. There's definitely down the street, I'd say across. So I live in a townhouse that's at the end of four deep, and then one house, and then the next. You guys don't give a shit at all, but like down the street, but not that far, they're building like 14 standalone townhouses.
Oh yeah.
And oh my god, I wake up every morning with the hammers and the nailing. And so if you hear any of that, you know what, fuck, that's just deal with it.
we have both a where I live, it's like this big loft building in the marina, and we have both a automotive shop as well as a huge construction site.
Love it.
So it's like in the morning I hear this like opening of like the garage doors, and then the construction starts at 7, and I'm like, whatever.
It's like they're trying to keep laws, you know, you can't do construction in the middle of the night, you can't do it after whatever p.m.
Right.
And you know, it's like, oh, you can't do construction after 9 p.m. and I'm like, please just go to midnight, don't fucking start at 7.
I know. I'm like, I write until 2, so when you start at 7,
exactly,
it really messes with me.
Not fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. So I want to know first about, so like backing up, right now you work on a show called Granite Flats. You're an actress on a show that is now in its fourth season.
Third season. We wrapped our third season and it's premiering. Is this Evergreen? Do I say when it's premiering?
Oh, you can. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's May 15th on Netflix.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
So yeah, anybody who's catching
I think most people listen to Talk Nerdy when it's first released, and then some people will batch listen in the end. So if you're listening to this new, because this episode is going to come out this Monday. So great.
Awesome. Yay.
So check it out.
And it has nothing to do with science.
What network is it on?
Well, it's on BYU TV. So it's the Utah PBS.
So interesting. I love it. So we're going to get into that.
Okay. Because it's a fascinating story. Yes. And the ecosystem of the show is really interesting.
Very strange. And it's got kind of like a Mad Men-y sort of a flair to it.
Yes.
It's sort of mid-century and has this really great costuming. And
yeah. But an FBI, CIA, like special ops, MK Ultra, like neuromanipulation element to
which
it,
is
and
also
Russian
like,
spies, and
like, what does that have to do with Utah? It's very strange.
Oh, it's so nothing to do with Utah. That's the thing.
We'll get into that in a minute. But first, you have this rich history of specifically like web series, mm-hmm. With a sci-fi flair, both acting, writing, producing, you know, really diving deep into this sort of sci-fi world. So where was the impetus for that?
Kind of like what I was first starting out was, I was in Vancouver. I was auditioning for a bunch of shows, and they all happened to be sci-fi because that's what was shooting up there. And I was collaborating with someone named Michael Davies, and we were working on this project together that had this superhero band, and I sort of had an idea for it. It was kind of had a Wonder Woman feel to it. This is when Joss was doing his Wonder Woman mm-hmm. feature that at Warner Brothers that never went. So it's strange how it's all full circle now. And I started really digging into the story from a science perspective, like from a genetics perspective, from a this is not science, but conspiracy. And I went down the rabbit hole and just started researching to create this alternate universe, basically, that this story took place in, much like what, you know, a comic creator would do. And it was so just awe-inspiring. I would like go for dinner with my parents and be like, oh my God, do you know what I learned about this and this and this? And they'd be like, who are you? Aren't you supposed to be auditioning up here, not like creating some weird like new action series world? And I'm like, I don't know. It's so fascinating. And then because that got too big, basically, for us to be able to do independently, he had written this sci-fi web series. Well, it was a feature that he broke down into like 60 episodes, and he sent me 10 of them, and I was hooked. I'm like, send me more, send me more. I'm going to produce this. You're rewriting this character so I can play her. Done. And we're shooting. And so we did. And this was during the writer's strike. This is when Joss Whedon did Dr. Horribles. So it was like the web series world just kind of elevated and jumped into the mainstream just because WGA writers couldn't be working.
And
so that's how it kind of happened. And it opened the door to research and sort of having this curious mind. And for some reason, I really, really wanted everything that I wrote sci-fi to have this underlying theoretical plausibility.
Yeah. And I think that's great. I mean, I think that that's something that just makes it that much more rigorous. And it allows for a growing fandom in a way that if something was just kind of made up, it wouldn't.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It doesn't hook in because there's no foundation to have an emotional investment if you know it can't be feasible at all. Mm-hmm. Like, how can you root and get emotionally connected to something if it's complete fairy tale?
And this is my historical problem with, and I shouldn't say problem with, but this is my historical reason why you wouldn't identify me as a sci-fi or fantasy nerd, but more of a science nerd, because I have historically just had such a hard time suspending disbelief. Sci-fi less so, fantasy way more so. Like, I don't, it's so sad. When I said the first time that I don't watch Game of Thrones on my podcast, I got all this hate on Twitter. And I was like, I'm sorry, you guys. And same thing with kind of like all the J.R.R. Tolkien stuff. It's just not my...
Harry Potter? No, it's just not my world.
I know. It's such a bummer, too. And I get these great loot crates in the mail. I should give you... I've got like the loot crate this month. It was like a fantasy loot crate.
Right.
I've got all this like...
Well, that's where it started for me, was fantasy. And it was because it hooked into the hero's journey, which I think can transcend, you know, any kind of medium, any kind of genre. Mm-hmm. And so it was definitely the Buffy was a huge motivator for me as a storyteller. I mean, it's why I started training in martial arts, because I was a figure skater and a dancer. And then I moved to LA and I started watching Buffy, and I'm like, I just want to be on that show, so I better learn how to kick some ass.
How funny. So almost all of this really started for you as a young adult. So when you were a kid, you weren't even watching like Willow or like any of these movies.
Oh, I loved definitely.
So it's not like you weren't exposed, but you didn't really have like the posters and the action figures.
I was a competitive figure skater, so I had no life. So I didn't live at home. I lived at a training facility in Montreal.
Jesus, really?
Yeah, so that was my life.
What era, like how old were the end caps on that?
Until I was 16.
Wow.
And so then I moved back home when I blew out my knees and went back to the school I went to in Vancouver. And that was just about academics and basically getting a life again and figuring out what it was like not to actually have to be up at 5 a.m. and, you know, and going to college. And so there was no, except for acting, then I sort of got into acting, but that was my only kind of extracurricular thing I did. I didn't dive into, you know, any sort of hobby that way.
Yeah. You didn't have time for a hobby.
No.
How hard was that? Oh, good. It's still working. I was going to say, I just keep getting all these, I'm telling you guys, my computer is on its last legs. How hard was that transition back? Because I know, obviously, I talk to people who were competitive gymnasts or competitive athletes who that's their whole world. And it's incredibly difficult. Obviously, it's incredibly challenging and trying, and you dedicate so much of your life to it, but it kind of is just what you do.
Right.
Like at a certain point that's my life. That's mm-hmm. what I do. I couldn't imagine doing something else. But that transition back, that transition away from it, like what was that like for you?
I had a terrifying fear of being normal because
of not being like special.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd always been really smart. Book smart, at least in high school, so and all through school, and so mm-hmm. there was always this sort of higher level of I had a bit of a tiger mom. She's lovely now, but she was really hard on me growing up.
Yeah.
Not hard, but you know, I'd set certain expectations of what I was able to do, and so she just wanted me to meet them.
But she wasn't a stage mom; she was really a tiger mom. Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. So much more like get your work done. You're going to be smart. You're going to be well-rounded.
Totally.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it's like even though you have skating in school, you still have to do piano. You still have to do this and excel at everything. So that was that. But yeah, transitioning back, it was – I just wanted to – A, have a break so that to enjoy my life. I got to a place where I wasn't enjoying skating at all. Mm-hmm. Like, I would love to go back now because I actually remember what drew me to it sort of intrinsically, even though I'd been skating since I was three. But then it was just like, it was a job that I didn't like anymore, that I wanted to get away from. So yeah, going back to school was kind of like, oh, I have this time and everything is relative, where it's like, exams weren't scary to me because compared to stepping on the ice for a 4-minute program that dictates how your entire season goes, going into an exam that you can study for was nothing.
Yeah. And like, you'll probably have a few more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not all this one test.
Exactly. So it was, it wasn't that bad, but then it was kind of like, I had always understood this sort of linear progression of my success of like, you worked hard, you had a certain amount of talent, and then you would get to a certain level, you get this result. And school was kind of like that too. But then when I took the chain, that's why I never pursued acting right off the bat in college, because I'm like, there's no linear equation for success. There's a bunch of chance, and like, it's based on looks and trends and this and that. But it came down to, you know, there's that hook of performing and of connecting with an audience and storytelling. And
so that really was something that was always intrinsic in you back from way back when you were dancing. I mean, not dancing on the ice.
Yes.
Because that's what that really is, right? It is storytelling.
Yep.
It is kind of, I mean, and that's really what, is it figure skating? Is that is that the way to put it? Ice skating, figure skating?
Figure skating.
Any of the terminology.
I was an ice dancer. At the end, I was an ice dancer.
Yeah, so it is dancing on the ice. I mean, that's really what you're doing, which is like extra hard. I can't even stay up on skates. Is this because you grew up in Canada?
Pretty like, much.
Do Canadians just kind of naturally know how to skate when they're
My
born?
My mother skated, and so she brought me to the rink when I was three, and I would watch her skate. And I'm like, oh, well, obviously I'm going to do that.
Picked it up from a very young age.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I think maybe because I grew up in Texas, that's just not a thing.
No.
So I've maybe been on the ice twice, and every time I end up with the biggest bruises all over my thighs. I'm like, this is not fun for me. I don't know why people would enjoy this. I suppose if you don't fall constantly, it could be quite fun.
The physics of it is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, you think it's an eighth of an inch of steel that is just about momentum and torque and like the, you know, centrifugal force and fighting gravity, and it's...
And skill. A lot of skill.
Yeah. But understanding like how our brain can calibrate just the tiniest little, you know, bit of steel to do something specific.
Or how my brain can't.
Right. So it was like my brain was wired at a very early age to be able to...
And the amount of practice and the amount of repetition obviously.
Huge.
That's amazing. So that really is kind of a natural transition then into acting, which is like a new stage, a new type of performance, and one where you're utilizing maybe your range of facial and vocal emotions in a different way than you were able to do, obviously, when you were ice dancing. So what made you want to launch into that career then? Because that's a big step, I feel like, you know, deciding. And I didn't go out on such a limb. You know what I mean? Doing what I do, which is mostly full-time science communication where I play myself on TV. You know what I mean? I'm just me. It's still very like unstable. This is an unstable career.
Cheers to that.
Exactly. There's no safety net. There's no... And I'm always fascinated by my friends who are working actors in Los Angeles, because I think a lot of people who live outside of LA look at this world as like a celebrity world, and they don't really understand that there are a ton of people who are working actors.
Yeah.
You know, they make money, but not amazing money. They make like the same way anybody who works in business or who works in construction or whatever. There's like the range. And so people do this as a daily job. They audition, they work, they get breaks and they make good money, and then they don't work for 9 months and they make no money. And it's very risky, but it's very trying and takes a lot of kind of emotional fortitude. So when you first went into it, did you have this idea of like, I'm going to be famous? Or were you like, you know what, I want to dedicate my life to this craft and I'm going to navigate these rocky waters as best as I can? Like, what was your understanding of the world of acting?
Well, my origin story that way. Mm-hmm. I came out to LA from Duke. I went to Duke. Mm-hmm. I was an econ major.
Oh, so you weren't even in theater
I had a theater minor and a film minor. And the film led me to a semester, the first semester Duke did abroad at USC at the film school. And I interned at Gersh.
Gotcha.
Agency and also a small production company that I did coverage at. It was just sort of a whim because I didn't get into the New York theater one. Uh-huh. And I loved, you know, I loved acting. I loved stage performing. I'd never done any camera in Vancouver. It was like I'd just done a bunch of musical theater. So that was all very broad.
Gotcha. So your conception of acting was, you know, stage makeup, belting, singing.
Yeah,
you know,
show hand, like, you know, all that kind
and
of.
And live, you know, energy, people in the room with you. Yes. Which, of course, being in front of the camera is very different. It's a vacuum.
Oh,
it's like,
oh,
one day maybe somebody will see this. But in the meantime, it's just me and you, buddy.
I'm best friends with the camera now.
Yeah.
And so, but it didn't make any sense to me to pursue a career as an actor. Like I had said, like out of college, I went to Duke, even though I did have, you know, one drama teacher who's like, maybe you should give drama school a shot. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, whatever. I'm valedictorian. I'm in a blah, blah, blah.
And so you were going to be an
investment banker.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
I'm like Goldman Sachs all the way.
You're like, how do you make money?
How do you be important?
Yeah.
So I went, I did the semester at USC and I fell in love with LA and the entertainment industry. I'm like, it's the perfect marriage of art and commerce. I'm going to be an agent. Are you kidding me? But I did. I
agents do make a lot of money.
They do. And it seemed like, oh, I'm going to be working with artists. I'm going to be able to understand their creativity, but I'm also going to have this acute business sense and I understand the commerce of it, not realizing sort of how dredge the world of being an agent is. It's just, but I moved out and I got my first job at William Morris. Okay. So I was on a desk. I was an assistant to a literary agent, big motion picture literary agent. Cut my teeth that way, was looking at maybe, you know, doing the traditional transition to a studio to work for like a studio head. Like there was, I almost had, you know, an interview with Stacey Snyder. And then this opportunity came up at a Canadian studio called Alliance Atlantis. Now, I didn't have a green card. Because I was Canadian, and so I had just had an extension of my, you know, my student visa. Mm-hmm. And so I needed a company that would definitely help me better with the sort of immigration stuff. So
yeah, because that's how it works, right? For a lot of people, if you can get the job first, then the company can actually help you get your green card. It's much harder to do it the other way around.
Well, I mean, because I kept, I would be able to move to a new company still under an umbrella visa I had, and then while working, they could sort of apply for this other visa for me, which then could lead to a green card. So the green card was like very far down in the future.
But so for a lot of people, it's like, it's almost a catch-22. It's like you need the job to prove that you have reason to come to the U.S. to work.
But can't get the job without...
Because you're not a citizen and you don't have legal clearance to work in the U.S. What a pain. Okay, so... So you're looking for this company.
I worked for this. I got hired by this company, and I was like a junior manager, and I had a bunch of clients and actors and writers and directors, and I was miserable.
Yeah.
Like, just miserable. I saw us turning into a career, and I'm like, this is really not what I want to be doing. And I ended up taking kind of a weekend workshop at sort of this famous acting studio here in L.A., and it was one of those, like, ethereal moments, just mind-blowing, where, you know, you were taken through all these different emotional exercises, and I was just like, I feel alive. I finally feel alive again. You know, the whole time I really had been wanting to pursue an acting career. I did a movie my senior year in college, and I just loved the process of it. But I was trying to be really pragmatic and smart, and it just kept, I just felt like I was doing myself a disservice. And so I quit. Basically, and was back and forth between Vancouver and LA, and then my husband and I ended up getting married, so I got my green card that way. And
because you had met him when you were here working.
So we had already we're already living together, and he was supportive of me sort of going back and forth. But it was just kind of this, acting for me was something akin to what brought me back my love of science and curiosity. I was that kid who always tried to figure out why we were here. I was the one who was like on the grass, looking up at the stars, trying to like wrap my head around how the planet existed and the vastness of the universe and how that's all there was. And, you know, it was just, I would think and talk about it. My parents were like, you don't have to worry about that sort of stuff. But they were the big questions that sort of always filled my mind. And acting sort of let me tap into that grandiose element of life. And that's sort of how I started again. But yeah, I wanted to be famous.
I love that. I love that.
Not anymore, really. But
I mean, I've historically had relationships with individuals who actually, you know, as anybody who can Google me and find this out, even though I don't talk about it much, who are in sort of the limelight. And they've been very candid with the fact that, like, there is kind of a level of, maybe not narcissism, but a level of, like, well, fuck yeah, I want to be famous. Like, that's a intrinsic to taking this kind of work, you know? And I think sometimes we skate around that, and you know, people humble brag a bit and they try their best to, but there is some sort of driving force, at least at the beginning, like mm-hmm. you said. I think once you're in it and you realize, you know, maybe the shit that they have to deal with might not be worth the money that they're making, or maybe, you know, you have to sometimes make decisions that aren't true to your core values, or, you know, whatever the case may be, and you go, it's not worth it to me, and I like being a working actor, or I like being a working person in this industry, you level out, you figure out exactly what it is you want. But at the beginning, at least, there's got to be that kind of, that dream, right? That twinkle?
That... Excuse me. You would think that my voice would be so trained being an actor, but apparently today it wants to quit on me.
Well, it was, I mean, you were eating like a kale salad. That's or something. True. You're so healthy. You're so healthy.
The movie that actually sort of compelled me to sort of take the proverbial stage again was actually Shakespeare in Love. There was just something really beautiful and moving. And I mean, I'd always loved Shakespeare since I was a little girl studying it in school. And there was just something so beautiful about how, what's his name? David Madden directed it?
I can't remember. I have no idea.
But it was just, I came out of it and I was just like crying. And I'm like, this is so beautiful. I want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And that was and I think it really came down again to the storytelling and the narrative where, you know, that was how I wanted to be a part of that sort of larger construct that moved people. I didn't realize that you could also be a part of that from a writing perspective. Well, I knew, but I never thought that, you know, well, I never wanted to be a writer. I thought script writing was like the worst thing ever. It just like brought me back to high school and having like countless essays after essays.
Yeah.
Or as a director, which seems so overwhelming to me, but that's definitely something that I want to do one day.
John Madden.
John Madden. I knew there was a Madden.
It took me that long to
Google
that.
I didn't want to say Steve Madden because I'm like the shoe guy who was in prison.
He was in prison?
He was in prison.
I had no idea. Yeah, I have lots of his shoes.
Tax evasion a while ago or something like that. Don't quote me on that. Okay. Yeah. I definitely know
Google
he was in
that
prison.
Too. That's crazy. Yeah. Sorry, random
no,
aside.
I know.
So but then so you have this realization, you decide to start building towards this, you know, doing the audition process, putting your emotional energy into it. But then you also early on, you told me, you just told all of us about this this idea to kind of launch into this web series. This was during the writer's strike. So how long after you kind of became an actress? This was pretty early.
This was like 3 years. So okay. I'd had some good early luck. Mm-hmm. I would say luck. I mean, I kind of jumped into pursuing it professionally now that I look back at it without the proper training. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was taking, you know, a ton of classes, but I really would love to have actually had a proper conservatory training program. Like I look at people like Jessica Chastain or something who came out of Juilliard or Yale and they had 3 years of just like there was no pressure of Hollywood. There was just learn your craft, explore, you know, your instrument, learn to play the 88 keys of, mm-hmm. you know, who you are. And I never had that because I understood the business side of it. And I was like, well, I know how this works. I know that I am good, or I thought I was good.
You're like, I know how to get a contract.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, and I know what they want because I, you know, can see on the other side of it.
But let's not pretend that that kind of savvy isn't incredibly useful in
which
this
is why
town.
I got into, it actually hurt me more than it helped me sometimes.
Really?
I would have managers being like, don't know so much. Yeah. You can't go into those rooms making people feel that you know as much or more than they do about the business and then being the actor.
Well, and that's really the juxtaposition there. I think that, like, for example, my experience is very lucky because as somebody who does do a lot of on camera, again, like I said, I'm myself on TV, and more often than not, I'm in a capacity as like a correspondent or a reporter. or even if it's edutainment, I have that broadcast sensibility that I'm bringing to it, which means it's intrinsic that I produce my pieces. Right. Like almost every job I've ever done, I've also been a producer on the job. And there's almost, and because most of what I do is science, I'm usually working with people who are very knowledgeable about production, but kind of need me to be the expert in the room about the science. So it's a win-win. Mm-hmm. But I definitely felt the tension when I went in for straight castings where they didn't want me to help them produce. They already knew what the show was. They wanted to drop me in as the host of the show, where it's like, sit and look pretty.
Right.
Like, be the person that they expect you to be, because you don't have anything to do with the production of this piece. And I mean, again, I look at my friends who are actors and I wonder, especially my friends who are, well, all of my friends who are actors are very smart. I don't surround myself with like some of the people that you meet in Hollywood that maybe you probably wouldn't want to spend a lot of quality time with. And so I look at my very smart friends who are actors for a living, and sometimes I wonder how they deal with some of the situations that you find yourself in where it's almost like expected that you not be bright, that you not use your brain.
Emotional intelligence. Like, you really have to compartmentalize and understand where it's coming from. That's usually out of insecurity on their part, and that you're just going to let them do their job, because everything in this business is very compartmentalized. You have this department, that department. Everybody has their own department. Nobody crosses over. God forbid you ask the makeup lady to help you with your hair, because mm-hmm. like, ah. And so, yes, your job is to be an actor and be this character and, you know, deliver your lines in whatever engaging way you're supposed to move the story forward. And hopefully everybody helps you do your job. And if someone asks you, you can help them do their job. But I had to learn, nope, I will not. You know, I have my focus and they have their focuses. And that's what you do. And then I go off and I sit in my chair and I read my science magazines. And then people come and they're like, oh, what are you reading? And it opens up dialogue, as opposed to, oh, she's the actress. You know, she's just an actress who is made to look like a 1960s mom, and, you know,
yeah,
she must,
I mean,
cook.
Is that why, though? Like, for me, that is why I podcast, is because I find myself from time to time in jobs where I don't have the opportunity to really take ownership, and I don't have the opportunity to maybe make it the way I would make it with a stronger science voice or whatever the case mm-hmm. may be. So is that why for you, this opportunity to like do a sci-fi web series, this opportunity to like write episodes, to develop characters, was so appealing?
Yes, because I needed some control back in my life. I mean, when I was in Vancouver, I was auditioning all the time. I was up for a ton of stuff and I would just throw my soul out there all the time. And then waiting for these calls, I mean, it wreaks havoc on you. And I've gone through these periods, you know, sporadically, because I really didn't. After I left Vancouver for a bit, I didn't do any TV and film. I just did commercials and web series, because it was devastating. I just didn't know who I was anymore. I didn't have my own personal identity. So when it was, oh, I can actually have something that can be a product of me, like a web series, writing mm-hmm. a script, even just having a presence out there above and beyond being an actress. Like, mm-hmm. oh, you're an actress. Oh, you're the actress who wears the multiple hats and who also takes her career in her own hands, because you can't just sit by the phone anymore.
Well, and that, like, just that mentality that you just, because, like, nobody could see you, but hopefully they could hear it in your voice, where it was like, oh, you're an actress. Like, I hate to admit, but I have been a perpetrator of that, I think. I've definitely been in rooms where people are like, so how long have you been an actress? And I'm like, oh, I'm not a fucking actress. Jesus. Where it's like, why would I be denigrating that in my head? Like, oh, that's not what I do. I do so much more, quote unquote, than that, which is like a shitty mentality to have. And maybe it's because when you actually live in Los Angeles, everybody's an actress. And mm-hmm. so it's hard to know who is actually an actress.
Right.
And
what does it actually mean?
Exactly. You know? And like, is it a sensibility? Is it an emotion? Is it a personality? Is it a career path? Does it require a certain amount of success before you can call yourself that? In the sciences, like, I can't call myself a neuroscientist.
Right.
People call me a neuroscientist and I'm like, I have to kind of correct you. Like,
but
I was trained. Yeah. Like, I was trained in the neurosciences, but I don't feel comfortable saying I'm a neuroscientist now, because I don't do neuroscience anymore.
Right.
And so it's like, And for some people, you know, obviously if you're a physician and you never get licensed, you're not a fucking physician, you know,
right.
Like, or if you're a psychologist and you never, you know, pass your exams, then sorry, you can't have that. But for other jobs, it's a little wiggly.
The fluid.
Lines are, yeah, the lines are a little fluid. And I mean, I hate to say it, but yeah, I have definitely been that person who kind of has turned my nose up at the concept of being an actress. Which is a shitty thing to do, because I think that culturally it's so reinforced in us that like actresses aren't bright or that they don't have anything to offer other than the way they look, which is like, what the fuck? Why, as somebody who's a huge advocate for like women in STEM and for the Gina Davis Institute, like right. for seeing more women on the screen representing strong characters, like who the fuck am I to be sitting here saying I'm part of the problem sometimes.
Well, I just think you're commenting on the problem that exists. You're not part of it because you're smart and you're self-reflecting right now. But you think of it like the lines are blurred now. Like, is Kim Kardashian an actress because she's in the media and she's on screen and she's kind of playing herself, but not really, you know, it's kind of scripted. Mm-hmm. And then you have, you know, trained, there's no, you know, you can call yourself an actress without having gone through medical school. Like, you can't call yourself a doctor unless you've gone through medical
yeah.
school. So you don't have sort of those credentials that you have to have. You can be 12 years old and call yourself an actress and 60 years old. Uh-huh. And it's just because you are slipping into the idea of a person. You mm-hmm. are portraying a person. Whether that person is, like, let's say you're an actor who plays herself all the time. Are you a really yeah. good actor? Because someone like, I don't know, Julia Roberts, who played the same character for a long time and was brilliant at it.
Yeah.
Now, you know, being natural in front of the camera, regardless if you're kind of playing yourself or not, is really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like there's an invisible camera following you around. Like, it's very, very technical. And so, you know, the more I act, the more I appreciate, the more I act on set, especially, the more I appreciate the true talents out there that have sort of had this long career and just have grown and haven't sort of rested on their laurels and sort of the characters that they've played. But I mean, we live in Hollywood where fame is so, there's, you know, it's so gross.
And that's the problem, I think. And that's where we get these like terrible preconceived notions about what it means, about whether something is rich and complicated or kind of vacuous and superficial. I think it comes from this idea that there are a lot of people here that are chasing fame as opposed to art. And I think that for me, what's most important, and like the whole reason that I want you on my show, and the whole reason that I think that you are incredibly necessary within the culture, is because it's not so much that it's less about what you do on stage. Obviously, that's very important, but it kind of it harkens onto this like Ask Her More campaign that, mm-hmm. that we saw on the red carpet where women were getting frustrated, being like, stop fucking asking me what designer I'm wearing. That's not what you ask the men. You don't walk up to the men and go, who are you wearing tonight? And they go, right. Tom Ford, over and over. Because it's like, no, you go, what was it like to play that character? Tell me about your experience. And it's like, ask the fucking women that. And so when I look at these people who have these brilliant careers, what are they using that platform for? I
right.
see these amazing women who have been so successful, who could, as you said, very easily just rest on their laurels, but that's not what they're doing. They're activists. They have strong messages for young women to be able to achieve their goals. They're pushing for gender equality. They're pushing for education and clean water and health initiatives across the world. They're pushing for social justice and civil liberties. And to me, that's like so amazing, because it's almost, it's a blessing to achieve a certain amount of fame, but it's also a responsibility,
mm-hmm.
and also to achieve a certain amount of privilege, financial privilege. And so seeing what you and your three sisters in the Sirens do is really important to me. And so that's, I want to spend a little bit of time really talking about that, because I don't think that I fully got to launch into it with some of the other Sirens. So I guess just open-endedly, first tell everybody who's listening who is like, what the fuck are you talking about there? Who are the Sirens? If they haven't been exposed, if they don't already follow you,
right.
tell them what you guys are about and why you exist.
So the Sirens are a collective of four science enthusiastic actresses. It's myself, Christina Ochoa, Tamara Krinsky, and Gia Mora. And we came together after I wrote this sort of impassioned blog post about STEM literacy and sort of how I'm a bit of a, you know, obviously a sci-fi nerd, but a futurist too. I love Ramez Nam and William Gibson, and I like Neal Stephenson. I love to look into the future and see what the world is going to be. And I see a world where the science and technology that drives our culture and our society is not understood by anyone. And
yeah,
that terrifies
more and more of a black box.
Yeah.
Totally.
And it terrifies me, you know, and I see just an ignorance just towards it. And people are like, well, why do I have to understand that? Because it's the natural laws that govern your existence, and it is going to, and everything's, you know, technology is going to proliferate like we've never seen it before in 10 years. And so this was after the Ken Ham.
Bill Nye debate.
Bill Nye debate. Mm-hmm. And so I just basically was like, you know what? I'm sick of all this ignorance. People need to be educated. This is why science is beautiful. This is why I believe that scientific literacy is important. As someone with a bit of a platform on social media, as an actress, I believe that actors especially actresses could be the secret cheerleaders for science, because they would be the least likely, as we talked about, we think, oh, you're an actress.
Yeah.
Wait, you're an actress who's out there cheerleading for science?
And
that's
also
weird.
Also, you have this perspective, because over and over, I mean, people like myself who's somewhere kind of in the middle, but I still definitely have a foot in that pool. Over and over, you see that the science activists and the science advocates are scientists themselves, or people who are like deeply entrenched in scientific endeavors. And so to see people advocating and promoting for science literacy that are coming from a totally different place, to me is like, duh. Oh my God, you can reach so many people will never be able to reach, because there's always a bit of an echo chamber no matter where you are. And so it's just such a great perspective.
I just saw us as a Trojan horse, basically.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good way to put it. Definitely.
You know, because all of us do have, you know, we have fans just as actresses. And so we're able to reach then those people. And hopefully as our acting careers, you know, get more can't even speak today. Prolific.
It's the end of the week.
I didn't do my vocal warm-up. more prolific, the more people that we'll reach.
Yeah.
You know, and it also stemmed from the fact that all four of us weren't just cheerleaders, because that's not a word we kind of like to use anymore, you know, advocates. But we all were heavily studying science individually. Tamara has her Science Lush blog, and Gia has her Einstein's Girl stage show, and Christina is actually, you know, trained in science and has her own science endeavors. And for me, I have like three different scripts going that are heavy in the science. And I would blog about sort of more, not science specifically, but I would sort of infuse science and critical thinking into my big blog posts. And they're all big idea blog posts.
And so it just is so important. Like, sorry to interrupt. No. I think that when we talk about science, that's an angle that I think, I appreciate when I see people taking, and it speaks to me, is yes, it's important to talk about science specifically and say, okay, there's this new discovery and let's write about it or let's communicate about it. But infusing the scientific method and critical evidence-based thinking into every aspect of our lives is so necessary. It should be the norm. It should be, but it's such an uphill battle. And so I really appreciate your efforts to do that, even when you're talking about things that maybe aren't ostensibly science topics.
Right.
To be able to have a scientific kind of angle on them.
And that's one of the reasons why I really believe that just having exposure to science and what it entails, even to an adult population that may not have science training, it just helps you perceive, you know, and address your life in a certain way, because we're going to have so many challenges. It's a noisy, messy world out there right now where there's sound bites and everybody believes everything they read. And you have to have this critical filter in front of you, you know, to be able to make your way in the world and not, I have this, I don't know if our cognitive capacity is sort of reaching its melting point right now.
Yeah, there's a lot to comb through, and to not have a bullshit detector can be really detrimental. I mean, I get messages all the time from people saying, is this true? Is that true? How do I counter this argument? Am I supposed to believe this guy? Am I not supposed to believe? And sometimes I engage on the internet with those things because I find them interesting and I want to dig deep. And other times it's like, it's too much. Mm-hmm. And that's for somebody like me who like has spent, you know, I don't even know, like 15, 16, 17 years of academic focus training towards this. I can't even imagine for somebody who maybe was a little bit scared off by sciences in the school, which I was early on, but ultimately embraced it. For some people who were scared off by the sciences in school, ended up pursuing a field that was a little bit farther away from the sciences and didn't get that kind of exposure, how difficult it must be to navigate these waters of like woo peddling and pseudoscience.
Oh, yeah.
And politicians on soapboxes arguing for very anti-science principles. And it sounds legitimate. I mean, they package it up in a really kind of brilliant
authoritative way.
Totally. And at a certain point, yes, I think there's a part of you that has to trust the experts. There's a part of you that has to go, okay, you know, I can read as much as I can on WebMD about this like weird bump I have, but at a certain point, like I'm going to make myself crazy. I just need to ask my doctor, right, and what he says goes. If we didn't do that, we can't be experts about everything. And so trusting authority figures is important, but even just having a basic level of understanding so that when the authority figures tell you what's going on, you go, oh, I can see why that's the case.
Unless you have an intrinsic, like basic language, mm-hmm, you can't understand the higher level language. It's like basic math and you can't understand calculus.
Yeah, and not everybody has to be able to do calculus,
no,
but if you can do basic math, you can understand why these aspects of calculus are important.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that's just, and you know what you were mentioning before, we're in a place where everything around us is so high tech. Every, you know, our refrigerators are robotic now, and
right,
there's, you know, everything. And we talk about basic engineering literacy, which is something that we're really lacking. I'm really lacking basic engineering literacy. And when people say, well, why is it important? Why do I need to know how my iPhone works? It's like, because it gives you autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a sense of independence so that you're not fully relying on everyone around you for everything.
Yep.
At a certain point when all we are like mindless consumers, I feel like there's a sadness that comes from that. There's a sense of like a lack of ownership of your own, you know, commanding your own future.
We've like returned to the feudal times.
Yes.
Where we have this feudal lords and we're the serfs.
Yes.
Because technology.
Because we don't, it's like, well, can you live without this? No.
Right.
Well, I'm going to dangle this over your head. Like, why would we allow that? Why wouldn't we want to take, you know, at least basic ownership? Granted, I'm not going to be able to make a fucking iPhone. Like if my iPhone breaks, I still got to take it to like the Genius Bar.
Right.
And be like, what is going on? But to understand the concepts of, you know, language, like computational languages and the concepts of circuitry. And this is why I think things like, have you heard of Little Bits? They're the coolest things I've ever seen.
Tell me about them.
I did a series for Morgan Spurlock's production company, mm-hmm, Warrior Poets. It hasn't come out yet, so I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to say. So I might be like making a mistake here by saying we went and visited the Little Bits facility. That's all I'll say, because the episode isn't out yet. But Google Little Bits. They're like, I don't want to liken them to Legos because they're so much cooler than Legos, but just like Legos are very unisex, there's nothing intrinsically male or female about playing with Legos, Little Bits have this capacity for everything from young kids up to adults to play with the ease of Legos, to play with engineering and circuitry, because they're these small blocks that are full circuits. And you need an input, you need an output, and you put them together. They're all color-coded. They snap together with magnets. They're so easy, and you can do everything from create temperature sensors to noisemakers to, I learned how to make an SMS doorbell. It was the coolest thing. So when somebody rings the doorbell, pushes this button, you get a text message.
That's so cool.
And it's like these little packages that you can buy online, and you can play with them in all sorts of different configurations. They were saying that some people whose their kids would leave their refrigerator doors open, they just make a basic little circuit that has a temperature sensor, but then it has an SMS signal so that if it drops below a certain or above, mm-hmm, it goes above a certain temperature, it sends them a text message so that they can be like, refrigerator door's open, I need to go close it. Like, it's brilliant because it's useful, but it's also like basic core circuitry training.
And it'll teach you to understand the coming era of the Internet of Things.
Yes, because the whole thing is, it's all about the Internet of Things. Everything's wired. Everything's online. And you've got to understand what that means because shit gonna break.
Oh, yeah.
And you're
going to
get frustrated.
And bad people are going to take over that stuff, too. So we have to have... We have to be mobilized in a way intellectually into it.
And of course, the thing that we haven't mentioned yet, but that's kind of an echoing theme on my podcast, is not just about personal autonomy and personal understanding, but about civic duty. And the more that we are have a basic kind of even just... I mean, when I say basic, I really mean basic, like a fundamental understanding of what the scientific method is, then... When we go to the voting booth, we can be utilizing our brains, evidence-based thinking, instead of our guts, our emotions, our truthiness to do that. I wanted to, there's a text that I got. I'm dominating the conversation though. So while I look up this text, I want to know some of the things that you've been able to do lately with Sirens. Like, is it mostly about advocacy? Is it mostly about activism? Do you guys have any events, or is it more about like making sure that you're always sharing exciting, like using social media as a strong platform?
We kind of have sort of different platforms that we work from depending on, you know, what we're each doing individually, mm-hmm. because obviously our day job is acting and that's what pays the bills and, sure. and writing, whatnot. And we sort of, it's like a case by case basis right now. So we do our social media, we do our Twitter, update our website occasionally if we do like a science field trip together, like we went to JPL.
Oh, that's fun.
For one of their...
And then you share that for everybody.
We did a NASA social for the Orion test launch, and that was really fun. Go to the, Museum of Anthropology or Natural History Museum. We'll do things like that.
And you guys are friends. I mean, it's like you'd be hanging out anyway.
Yeah.
That's cool.
No,
I love that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then we sort of have another arm where it's like we get a lot of requests for things. We did a video for this girls engineering group in Arizona. So we just basically, they were finishing up a program and the instructor wondered if we would just do a shout out video to them. So we had, because we had done something with the Science and Entertainment Exchange, we had been hooked up with XPRIZE. Mm-hmm. So we met over there and we're talking about how we can collaborate. There's a lot of collaboration discussions that go on.
Yeah.
With a lot of different groups, some that I can say, some that I can't. And so we use their facilities and they shot a video and we used it for International Women's Day as well. So those kind of things where, you know, just being out there and saying why we love science, why we believe, especially women in STEM is so important. I did a panel for Gina Davis. Mm-hmm. Last year around this time, and it was fantastic.
Is her institute? I mean,
I have like three different projects that I want to do with them.
That's really cool. I mention all the time Jennifer Siepel Newsom's movie Misrepresentation,
yes.
which I think is very similar in its attempts to what Gina Davis Institute is trying to do, which is like see women represented in the media in a way that is first representative of real life,
right,
and second, inspirational to young women so that they don't just think, Jesus, I don't have a lot of options.
Right.
Like it's not
it's
the
so
50s.
Simple, their log line. If you see it, you can believe it.
Yeah.
Like, and it's so clear cut. And that's one of the things when I wrote the original blog post as an actress, I'm like, I am going to, even if I can't determine this, I am going to always try to angle for those roles, mm-hmm. those STEM roles. If I have the opportunity to be involved in a creative capacity from a development standpoint, I'm going to push for those type of roles as a woman. And then also, you know, as a writer producer, those are the sort of projects that I want to ultimately produce. Those, we as Sirens are sort of slowly developing those kind of projects as well.
That's great.
So we do have sort of a development, not production arm, because we're not producing anything ourselves yet, but we definitely have, we're all storytellers.
Yeah.
We're not just like put on the hat of actress, that's it.
And so not only are you actively working towards making content that has these strong female STEM characters, but you also, when you see other women in the industry, you support them, promote them, you draw attention to them, and you help individuals who maybe aren't following as closely, but who are following you guys on social media, they'll be able to see your tweets and your Facebook posts about, check out this great new project that so-and-so is in, check out this great new character that so-and-so is playing,
yeah.
which is huge because
again, like, we don't have time in the fucking day to follow everything. And so when people are naturally good at certain things and they have natural kind of platforms and, yes, and authority in those areas, we as consumers of that can benefit from it, you know? I learn a lot by following you guys on Twitter that I would never...
Oh, good.
Yeah, I'm bad at social media.
No, I love curating. I love it because I suck at it.
I hate it. And so to be able to see you doing that is like, I don't know, it helps me, definitely. I definitely retweet you guys a lot. So, okay, I got this tweet from... Tyler, who is at Ari Little Kitty.
Hi, Tyler.
Hi, Tyler. She looks amazing, first of all. I think she's young, I think, maybe in high school. I really want to have a conversation with you that I can in no way fit into 140 characters. Thank you so much for being a voice of reason. It keeps me down to earth when I think of you. I heard two boys in my class debating evolution in school, and they ended up saying that, quote, we shouldn't use science to justify science if we can't use the Bible to justify the Bible. There's a bit more to the story, but that's the basic idea. Thank you for keeping me grounded. And it makes me stop and realize... Like, when I heard that, we shouldn't use science to justify science if we can't use the Bible to justify the Bible, that intrinsic in that statement is a fundamental misunderstanding of what science is.
Science is not a belief system.
Yeah, and the problem is that it's like, I don't blame these boys, these high school boys. I'm sure that this form of thinking is directly reflective of what they're being taught.
Right.
It's directly
it's a great soundbite.
Yes, of their parents, of whatever the political machine is that they, you know, are hearing in the background, if Fox News is playing at home, what their pastors might be saying, and even what might be happening in whatever school district that is. And so it's like it makes me feel, first of all, amazing when I get tweets like this, because it reinforces that, like, even when I'm not doing so well in my career, that I got to keep trucking, and thank you. But it also sort of saddens me. But more than that, it lights a fire under my ass of, like, all the way from the big things, like writing a script, getting a starring role in a film, all the way to the small things like a tweet, 140 characters, mm-hmm. writing something that might touch somebody in their lives to go, okay, I'm not alone in this craziness, and these boys are not representative of truth. Like, there are people out there who know what it means to think scientifically and use evidence, and I'm on that path. I mean, that's huge, and that's a big thing that you and your fellow sirens are doing. So I thank you for that. So we're getting close to the end. I know, it's a bummer, but I've got two questions that I ask everybody at the close.
Yep.
You're prepared, you know.
No, I don't.
So,
I forget.
Oh, good. Okay. Yay. Good. Okay. So no. The first one, I like catching people off guards even more. So the very first question is, when you think to the future, as somebody who, you know, dabbles in futurism, basically two things. One, what is most worrisome for you? What keeps you up the most at night? But then on the flip side, maybe to end on a more positive note, what are you most optimistic about and excited about?
So many things keep me up.
Are you a worrier?
No, I started out in, like, post-apocalyptic. But my sci-fi web series is post-apocalyptic.
Oh, yeah. I forget. This is the shit that you think about, like, on the regular.
Yeah. It's very dark and brooding and scary, and the robots take over the world. What concerns me most from a macro perspective is the acceleration of technology, artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, how we're moving so quickly, even just, you know, amazing things like nanotech, all that have that positive bent to it that can do so much good, but that can also do so much bad if it's in the wrong hands. And there's a lot of malicious, troubled people out there that I think that this connected world has allowed an audience and allowed just a feeding factory of. And so you have, you know, I think that the good will proliferate because of the connectedness of our society, and the bad will also, because you can just build your audience, basically.
And so for you, it really is about, on the bad side, at least, it's about the people. It's not about, because you hear a lot of people saying, like, oh, it's when the robots become conscious and it's when the whatever. But, like, I think it's so prudent to say, okay, before we get to that, what about people making decisions that are detrimental and having more of a platform to do it, the more connected we are. Mm-hmm. I think that's very insightful. You might be the first person who has actually, you didn't say climate change.
No.
Everyone says climate change, which granted is totally, yes.
Climate change is just, I think, a given.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's like unstated at this point. But I think that's really insightful to make that kind of comment, because it's true. I mean, there's still this fundamental human flaw, and there's still a lot of kind of darkness. There's still a lot of people who are very troubled, who can lash out in ways, and the way that they can lash out is becoming more and more dangerous.
And I think where we are right now, because of the proliferation of social media in such a short amount of time, is we really are digital teenagers. Mm-hmm. We're still kind of ruled by our hormones. Mm-hmm. We're still getting off on the hits that we get from every Facebook or notification or tweet. And so, you know, there's no driver's ed to teach you how to deal with this. We're mumbling along and maneuvering along just like we're a 13-year-old, like, you know, getting boobs for the first time and going like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. It's kind of awful. Like,
see YouTube comments.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, I was so terrified. I did an episode of a Machinima YouTube series and I was playing Lara Croft and I'm like, get ready for the you're ugly, fat, old, blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah. Like, I already had that kind of mechanism set up.
Which is good. It's good to already have a skin for that, because especially more than anywhere else, I mean, you know, the podcast people are super amazing. It's in like Instagram, for example.
Right.
Compare Instagram to Twitter. Compare Twitter to Facebook, and then compare Facebook to YouTube. Like, there's definitely places where it's true fans that hang out versus anybody can say anything. And I don't know why. I talk about it all the time, but YouTube, God.
I don't know why, just, as an ecosystem, it's so toxic.
It really is.
It's just like,
yeah. It's a bummer, too, really, because it's such an amazing platform. And there's so much good that comes out of it. But yeah, you read those comments and they can be so toxic.
And I have a lot of friends, because when I started in the web series world, a lot of them deviated into the YouTube, you know, vlogging world. And it was sort of the second year that I was producing a new series. I have all these friends from the original web series that now have like millions of subscribers, mm-hmm. and everything. And they're fantastic. And then you see what they have to deal with from a personality standpoint of their fans or their non-fans. It breaks my heart.
Because you can't just fully ignore. I mean, you can. For some people, that's their MO, is just fully ignore. But it's also like there's good stuff in there too, and you almost feel an obligation to your fans to listen to the critical feedback and the positive feedback and be there for them and have a feedback loop. But
because it shapes you as a consumer commodity,
yeah,
in a way.
It totally does. Yeah. If you can hear what the people who are consuming your content want and help drive that, it's important. But at the same time, it's like, fuck, especially women the internet. It's really tough. That's a common theme that we echo here on the show.
The Monica Lewinsky TED Talk actually really affected me. The internet trolling. The shaming TED Talk, mm-hmm. she gave in Vancouver. I wasn't expecting to like it, but it was well written.
Oh, that's good to know. Check that out, guys.
Yeah.
All right. So on the flip side, though, what are you most excited about? What are you looking forward to the most?
I mean, it's more of an ethereal comment, but I just kind of love where we're going as this sort of, we've become sort of this growing hive mind. Like, I can only feel how much I've grown intellectually and emotionally because of who I've been exposed to, because of the internet, mm-hmm. And because of this connected society. And I feel like we're sort of stepping away from these rigid constraints of, especially as a woman, like what was expected of me and, you know, this framework that as a woman I was supposed to live by and have kids by this age and this and that. No, I'm redefining the paradigm of what I choose my life to be like. And I'm being influenced by so many amazing, wonderful people. And I feel like the further we walk away from these institutions that have sort of kept a cap on us, mm-hmm. I think there's the opportunity for such sort of enlightened growth. I'm excited when we can actually look at ourselves as a planetary civilization. There's just something that's like the fact that we can have astronauts tweet pictures.
So crazy.
It gives me like the goosebumps.
Yeah.
It makes me so happy. Like I'll go to see the Hubble IMAX and I'll just bawl because I think our planet is so fucking beautiful.
And it's like, it's the exact opposite of, you know, sectarian conflict. It's mm-hmm. the exact opposite of people who are so similar. Like literally people who come from the same place and who have the same religion, but a slightly different version of it, like literally wanting to kill each other.
I know.
take that extreme example on one side and then go all the way to the other side where no matter what our differences are, no matter how incredibly, there's a global society. And the truth is we're all human, like the human species is so binding. Mm-hmm. And there are still, you know, less differences amongst us than there are amongst probably different alien species right. that exist out there. And we are a global society that really, hopefully soon, will learn to value that.
And there's this amazing, one last thing, there's an amazing lecture that was filmed at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo. And I think his name is Cameron Smith. And he's a anthropologist, but sort of a, you know, alien anthropologist in a way. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how the strength of human species to be able to survive on an exoplanet will be its diversity. That is the way that we need to survive, not homogenous cultures. It is our diversity. And, you know, he goes through a bunch of things, but it's a fascinating talk. And just to think of what gives us strength, it's our differences.
Definitely. It's what gives us the leg up in business. It's what gives us the leg up in culture, in family. The more that you have people with different backgrounds, different experiences, different genders, different colors, different sexual orientations, they're bringing all these perspectives to the table. It's when everybody is the same that you only have one solution to a problem. But when everybody's different, now you've got 20 solutions to a problem, and ultimately you're going to be able to solve it. And that's incredibly powerful. And it's something that we sometimes forget, I think. So, Taryn, thank you so much. This was so much fun. It was really enlightening.
Oh, thank you. I feel like this was awesome.
I got to learn so much about you that I never would have been able to just in, you know, casual conversation at our science salons or
right.
at different events that we see each other at. So, really, it made my day. I'm glad you came out. But before we go, will you let everybody who's listening know where they can see your work, how they can, you know, give you a shout out on the social media, all that
good stuff. On the interwebs.
Yeah, on Tay Interwebs.
My name, basically, Taryn O'Neill. So Twitter is at Taryn O'Neill. I have a website, taryn o'neill.com. Two L's.
And one more time, Granite Flats premieres, season 3 premieres.
Season 3, and you can catch the first two seasons on Netflix May 15th.
Oh, great. Oh, very cool.
I think it's 15th. But yeah, you can just Google graniteflats.com, and it's fascinating. It's a family-friendly series, which is the Utah thing.
Yeah.
But besides that, it, you know, has Christopher Lloyd. So if you want to geek out and see Christopher Lloyd and George Newbern from Scandal and Parker Posey, who is amazing.
I love Parker Posey.
Like, we have the coolest cast, and it's quirky and 60s, and there's kids and there's adults, and I almost have an affair with George Newbern, and
uh-oh.
It's very exciting.
Also, and it's on Netflix, which is huge.
Yeah, no, we just announced it.
That's so great.
That we did the licensing deal with them.
So many of my like fans and followers will reach out and be like, I don't have TV, Kara. I need a way to see this stuff on the web. And I'm like, I'm sorry. So it's always great when everybody can access something.
Right.
By just going right there on their Apple TV or whatever.
Or out there. Awesome. And thank you so much for everything you do. Like,
aww.
You are such a beacon of like cool, smart, independent woman online. Like, you really inspire us. So
stop.
Thank you.
Or go on. All right. Well, again, thank you for being here. Everybody out there, thank you for supporting the show week after week and coming back. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk about it.